Blog Talk Radio.
On the Edge, real talk about real issues.
Everybody, welcome to the On the Edge show with Katie Barnett and friends. I'm your host, Katie Barnett. All right, here we go. Happy Veterans Day, everybody. Happy Monday to the rest of us. And thank God for another day of being here, making it to a new week. Without him, nothing's possible. With him, everything is. All right. Today, we are going to be saluting our military, the past veterans, the present, the future, because Lord knows that without these young men and women and these older men and women's history, we would not be able to feel safe or feel secure in our homeland over here. And these guys are doing a big, exclusive, crazy job that the average American wouldn't get up and think of as our first choice. So we want to give them, I want to invite all you vets that are out there, all of you current soldiers, the family members and loved ones, you can show if there's anybody that's not with you right now that have been deployed to whatever location the government has asked them to be. You can kindly say something on the air and somehow, some way, we will get them to listen in. And you can say a special message. If not, we will definitely put it out on our show site, on Facebook. And I also want to hear from you vets out there. We want to say thank you in person. So before we get to our topic, let's start with our shout-outs. Now, ladies and gentlemen, those of you that have been around with me know that I am also a worker for Madison Square Garden in New York City. And last night, I saw the cutest, most impressionable thing from a young lady. Now, we were working the first of two games that were played in the Garden last night. One was the Knicks game versus the Spurs. And this young lady was here with her dad and her grandfather. Her name is Sarah. Sarah, just at the third or fourth quarter, I think it was the fourth quarter, it was like the almost ending of the fourth quarter, she came to order at our stand, and there was no cotton candy because we don't sell cotton candy. It's an individual vendor that walks around the halls calling out, and people buy from, you know, the guy that's walking. Well, this little girl wanted cotton candy. Now, us looking, we workers thought that the little girl was looking for cotton candy because she wanted cotton candy. But we came to find out that there was a whole different reason why this young lady was going crazy to try to find a bag of cotton candy. And I told her that it impressed me so much that I would give her a shout-out on today's show. So one of the things was she went through, missed the entire last part of the fourth quarter in the game itself, looking for the cotton candy guy who had apparently already left. And she started to get kind of teary, you know, teary-eyed. So my supervisor and I, we called down to the vending to make the guy come up personally to give her a bag of the, she can buy a bag of the cotton candy. We found out, and she waited and waited until they finally came upstairs. And then it turns out that her little sister, Goldie, was sick, and she couldn't make the Knicks game. So this little girl didn't want her little sister to not have a piece of the garden with her. So she waited and waited, and she waited a good 45 minutes. After the game was over, everybody was leaving the building. We were preparing for the next game, and she waited, crying when she thought at first she couldn't get this candy. And when we brought it up, she was so happy, and she told us, my little sister wasn't able to make it here today, so we wanted to bring her back something so she could have a piece of the garden. So good for you, Goldie, because who says that little sisters are pests or big sisters are mean? Good for you. You go out there and you show the rest of your friends what it means to be a charitable human being, okay? So from the On the Edge show, we say congratulations on being a great big sister. And to you, Dad and Grandpa Izzy, very good on that one. On to our next shout-out, Mr. Barry Mason, formerly of 98.7, Kiss FM Radio. currently with iSoulRadio.com. You can hear Barry do his thing on Saturdays from 7 to 10 p.m. and again on Sundays from 6 to 10 p.m. Mix it up with him because you never know what you're going to get when Barry brings the mix out there. And when he's not doing that, look for him in a party mode as a CEO of Track One Entertainment, giving the best of R&B events across New York City. To my team, Lady Diamond, Elaine Yeves, Monster Miles, DJ Dilmerk, Rodney Williams, and, of course, our favorite panelist and activist, and officially this segment's co-host now, is Mr. Deacon Denny Williams of Toledo, Ohio, somebody that has brought quite a bit of community activism, not just that, bridging the gaps, bringing us topics, having his great viewpoints. So for my team members out there listening, thank you very much, Deacon. Thank you for all that you have done and all that you are continuing to do. And he's also a veteran. So tonight is about him as well. To the rest of you out there who has now brought up our listenership to 15,097 people listening out there, thank you very much for all your continuing support. Thank you for the suggestions that you have sent in, for bringing your stories to the panel, for those of you that's inboxing your stories and allowing us to speak about it on the air. Thank you very much. To the Real World Black News and Discussion Group, thank you guys for consistently bringing your viewpoints to our pre-broadcast topic questions. Thank you all very much. Now, tonight we once again are saluting the military, past, present, and future. We are also going to be talking about both the good and the bad that they go through from way back when to current nowadays. One of the things that we wanted to speak about is the differences in the mindset of the troops then to the troops now. And the things that they went through, the things that nowadays the troops are going through, what it is that we as civilians perceive them to be, and also what it is that we need to really understand of them, what they're doing far beyond the war movies you see, far beyond Commando, where everything has a great ending in the end, all the things that you see that, you know, it makes a great blockbuster hit. It's more than that for these young men and women. So just to let you know, when we come back, we are going to start this show on the road, and I'm expecting a particular former soldier in here, and all the rest of you are welcome to join in. So we're going to start off with a special dedication to you guys from the On the Edge team. This is to let you know, those of you that are out there abroad, that we are out here supporting you big time, and that, you know, you can lean on us when you come back in, because those of us that know what you go through from a family standpoint, or what protection means to us, or for those of us that lost people on the 911 day, attack day, and the Pentagon, this is the things that we feel about you. You guys are out there making sure as much as you can this doesn't happen again. So from us to you, here's Angel with Celine Dion and R. Kelly. Be back in 3.5 minutes.
Some climbing space. Oh yeah. No rims to
You're listening to On the Edge.
Welcome back, everybody, to the On the Edge show with Katie Barnett and friends. I'm your host, Katie Barnett. Okay, that was from us to you guys. You know, you're out there fighting every day. You're missing your families. You don't know if you might be home or not for your holidays. So I want to let all of you know that there are people back here on the home front that's listening and rooting for you guys and wishing you safety and protection under God's hand out there and that you can come home safely. I see you, panelists. I'll get you in just a minute. Those of us that are here are being afforded the safety of not so quick to attack homeland attacks out there every day. It's time for all of us to start realizing that the military needs our support, morally more so, okay? And we also need to sit up here and really listen to the political talks that's going on so that some things we need to vote against. Because I was having a talk with a few of the veterans. Veterans, for me, meaning the old timers, the people that have been through the earlier parts of the military, and versus who I'm seeing coming now. Now, all of you have heard our previous military segment, which we spoke directly about the recruiting commercials that the military have put out there. And my gripe with it is not trying to get young men and women to join the Army. My life is the way that they have these commercials, making it seem like it's some glamour thing to do without giving them what the other side is. And when you see that more of our soldiers are returning home disabled, either physically or mentally, okay, they're coming back with missing limbs, and then when they get here, most of them are wind up in a train station in a wheelchair begging for food, which shouldn't be, because, you know, they should have nothing but the best from the country they serve to be cared for when whatever the casualties of war or otherwise happens to them and they return. They should be able to come back to a place that welcomes them. So these are one of the things that I find a problem. Now, one of the things which I will ask our panelists when they come in that I believe that my parents' generation, when they made the choice or was drafted into the Army, they understood exactly what it was they were fighting for. I think they understood the political talk. They understood the issues. And they had the patriotic honor in them if they chose to go in, of course, not the ones that were drafted. But I think even the ones that were drafted, once they got there, they could feel like it was worth something. But nowadays, the Army, to a lot of these young people, is more for college and more for even being able to go out there and be able to shoot somebody legally. Or that's the glamorization of it all. I don't think the troops out there even understand what the hell it is that they're actually fighting for. I know what they're being told to do. They're being told to do an assignment. But do they really understand? So now, let's bring in our first panelist for the evening, and we will get the discussion underway. Welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Lady Barnett. How are you?
How are you, Deacon? First of all, let me say thank you, sir, for your service to the country, for qualifying to be president.
It was my honor. It was my honor to do so.
So tell us, this is one of the issues that we have today on the show. We're saluting you guys, all of you, the ones that have served their time and come out, the ones that are going in, those that have not made it here, we honor them. And those that are going to be in the future military. So we want to just say thank you, because even those that are deciding to go in deserve our thank you, because the average person is not going to think of that as a dream job. So
right.
Let me ask you, Deacon, do you believe you went into the tours more back in the earlier days, 70s, around that time?
70s.
I personally believe that my parents' generation, your generation, grandparents, they were more with the patriotic honor of going to war. okay? They understood the political talks. They really understood and had a comprehensive grasp of what it meant to be a soldier. Okay, whatever benefits came with being a soldier was secondary in their mind. Nowadays, I don't think that the children going into war are doing it because they understand it from a patriotic level, with the exception of those that are like, you know, third-generation soldiers, meaning that they're grandfathers, their great-grandfathers, their fathers were all soldiers, and this is like a family tradition thing. But what's your take on that? Do you agree?
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me, Deacon?
Okay, you have faded on me.
Okay. Well, do you agree that the soldiers nowadays don't have the full patriotic understanding of what it is they're doing out there versus the ones that went around your day?
No, I don't think they do. They're given the impression that they're going in there just to get an education, and they don't realize that during a time when there's not a war, when a war breaks out, a lot of that stuff gets put to the side because you're going to be trained to do military duties, and your military duty is to defend this country. So that's going to come first. You're going to get fully trained, and believe me, they do it very well. When I was in there, it was doing for a circumstance that was beyond my control because I was sent there by a judge. So that was a different story. So, but I've learned a lot from it because it educated me and allowed me to learn what it was like to become a man. I became a man when I was in the military. So. And was doing a lot of crazy stuff on the streets, but I learned. But like I said, the idea that some of these young people have of going into the military, they can get a free ride to college, and it's going to be like one big party, but that's not the case. You're going to have somebody in your face telling you what to do it, and how to do it. And if you're not prepared for that, it's going to be a shock to your system. But after a while, you'll learn discipline. You'll be physically fit, that's for sure, and you will be well fed, that's for sure. Okay. So, but it helps. It really does help build character and builds your confidence and everything else that comes along with it. But I don't want some of these young men to think that it's just about college and getting a good job or getting a good pay or something like that, because it's more than just that. You have to realize that you are representing this U.S. of A., and that's a lot of responsibility because you're in there to sworn to protect and serve. And
you know,
once you're in there, you're Uncle Sam's property. You are a government property.
Right. That's one of the things that I had tried to talk to a lot of these kids. Now, I speak with you often about the my viewpoints on war. Now, I'm not against United States defense, and I think I've said this repeatedly on the previous segment. I'm not against, you know, us needing to defend ourselves. I am against the way that the commercials glamorize coming into the military branches. I don't like the fact, I've spoken about that. I don't like, because nowadays these children are dealing with so much of the unpopularity, the need to fit an image, the need to be, you know, fit in somewhere. And usually the ones that these commercials hit right away are like the fat kid that was called fat, the ones that are not very cute to the average person in their mind, the ones that feel bad about themselves. And if they're sitting on a couch watching this in the middle of some video game and they're going, hey, they'll take me as I am. I'll just get up and I'll go. They're going by the fact that they just saw some physically fit actor, you know, swinging from a bungee cord through a jungle, landing perfectly on an X target, smiling up at his helicopter friend, you know, not realizing that they could be in training and watch their friend get blown up and die.
Right. Right.
Okay, or if they go into the army, they could be in the middle of Christmas dinner. If the government declared a war, they're coming to get you. Like you just said, you belong to the government now.
Right.
You may not come back being able to have them nice muscles anymore. You might not have an arm. You know, these are the things that needs to be understood, and they need to explain to them that it's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it. Are you fit for it? It's tough training, but we give you this. It's not just that you get the good stuff. Don't show the candy before you show the long walk to the candy store.
Right. But you have to realize, too, even if they do show those commercials and try and glamorize it, everyone that goes into the military, even during wartime, some of them might never see action.
Indeed.
You know, if they're fortunate enough, it all depends on where their orders are sending them to. So it's not a guarantee that you might even see action. So, you know, and that's including during wartime. So, you know, I've known quite a few military men that have been in the military and then was during wartime, and they never even saw action.
I have a few people I want to say thank you to that's out there. My son, Stanley, he's not out there, but he is in the Army and could be called at any time. My nephew, Keith, who's in Kuwait right now. My auntie loves you, baby. Be out there. Be safe. God bless you. I want to say thank you to Michelle Ruffin because she used to be a soldier. I want to thank you to Tony Brown, who I hope we'll hear from him today. He is disabled in a wheelchair, and he served the country in the Marines. I want to thank all of you that are out there every day being willing to serve your tours, being willing to cry and say goodbye to your loved ones as you go over there to defend our sorry butts. So just thank you. And thank you, Deacon, once again, for doing your part. There's another panelist coming in. Let me bring them in, sir. Hold on. Welcome to the show, caller. You're on the air.
Good evening. This is Brother Larry.
Hello, Larry. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Hey, Larry. What's going on?
Oh, Brother Minister, fine, thank you. So good to hear your voice.
All right, okay. All right. Same here.
Well, Larry, is there anybody out there that you want to say thank you to, and did you serve yourself?
Well, I was in the Army.
Well, thank you, sir.
In the mid-70s, yes, in the mid-70s. And you're hitting on a topic that is very heavy, you know what I'm saying?
Larry, there's some interference coming from your end over there.
Pardon me, ma'am?
There was some interference coming in. Okay, it's a little better now. Go ahead.
Okay. You're hitting on a heavy topic about the war, you know. I met a friend of mine. Well, he wasn't a friend of mine. His son got shot in Fort Greene, and he packed up his clothes and moved. He was a veteran from Vietnam era. And I met him moving, and I helped my friend, who was a friend of his, to complete the move. And we was up at his house talking, and he was talking about what happened to his son. And he sent my friend to the store to go get, you know, a bottle of liquor or so, I don't know, whatever it was. And when his son went to the store, minister, he began to talk about the time when he was in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And he said he was in a chopper, and the white man was doing the driving. And he said they went through the village, and he said that he got the orders to shoot. And he said he
uh-huh.
killed men, women, and children. And this, he told me this in 2004, but the Vietnam War was like in the 60s and 70s. That's correct?
Right. Right.
Right.
And I was wondering, something was bothering him, for him to tell me something like this. And I go a little further. God said, thou should not kill.
Uh-huh.
And it is sad today. And the patriotness of my people is beautiful. But it is sad when we go kill people for a people for no justified reason whatsoever. It is sad.
Yes,
it is
bad.
I frankly don't like war, period. I don't agree with it, but I will not under any circumstances take away from the need for it at a point. I just don't feel like that should be any country's primary focus. That's number one. Number two, I think considering the fact that they are random picking people to draft in or trying to solicit them to think that the art of war is something that they want to focus on straight out of high school, I mean, that bothers me. But the thing that I see is we as civilians, we have to start really, and I'm not talking about those that are family members or relatives of military personnel, because you all understand that. You understand firsthand, you know, what it's about. I'm speaking to those of you that have never met a person or related to a person that has been affected by being in the military, not necessarily on the battlefield either. Like you said, Deacon, some of them will never see action, but it doesn't stop the pencil pushers or the cooks or the computer people from having to run for cover if there should be a bomb near the station
right.
that they're working in. So they're affected by everything that's out there, even though the ones on the battlefield are affected a lot more. But they're affected by it. Those of you that do not have a I see you, caller. I'll call you. I'll bring you in just a minute. Those of you that do not have the experience of dealing with a person that's been affected by the war, that has been in the military, that knows about the cold sweats when they wake up, believing that they heard a boom and it meant something different to them, you don't understand that the war movies you see in the blockbuster theaters is just a scratch of what these poor soldiers are going through.
That is true. And what is, you know... Brother Minister, the United States would not be as great as she is if it were not for the black man and now the black woman.
Correct.
You can
Correct.
Have a million bombs, but if you don't have 500,000 men and women to shoot those bombs, you're not that strong.
Correct.
And
right.
I think what has to be done now, because you was talking about the young boys, they got the recruits in the school and the recruits on the station and the advertising education and all this stuff. And like you said, not necessarily so. You know, you might,
right.
your first, when I was in there, a friend of mine started crying because the sergeant in our boot camp said, I'm going to make you a killer. And my friends, he kept saying, man, I'm not a killer. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Right.
We need our politics to say, Mr. Bush, you have to sit down with us and tell me why should my son and daughter go kill. You understand
right.
what I'm saying? And Brother Minister, I'm sure you can agree with me on this matter. The United States has did more damage to people in other countries than she has done to us. As a matter of fact, Iraq is now going to the world's court to bring her to court, America, for what she has done to her country.
Yes,
they
thank
you,
Bush.
They want to sue her. They want to sue the United
Bushes.
States.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Republicans, period. All right, I have another caller, and I have to bring them in. Just give me a second. And welcome to the show, caller. You're on the air.
Good evening, ma'am and sir. I find your discussion tonight very interesting.
Okay.
I'm a veteran
of the
United States Army. I served
Thank
18
you, sir.
Months.
God bless you. God bless you.
Yes, sir.
Thank
yes,
you.
Sir.
Thank you. I served 18 months in combat in Vietnam, 10 months in an infantry unit, mechanized infantry unit, in the militarized zone, Northern I Corps, Quang Tri Province, 1st of the 5th Brigade, mechanized infantry, and another with the 1st of the 77th Armor. I was a tank commander with the 77th Armor with that same unit. And I got 19 buddies who I knew very well whose names are on that memorial wall in Vietnam. I stayed in the National Guard when I got out of Vietnam. I got called up for the first Gulf War, and I went back again, although I didn't see any combat because the war was over so fast, the ground war anyway.
Wow.
We were training to go into combat. And I did get deployed over into Kuwait, into Saudi Arabia for training in preparation to go to combat. But look, this meme, and I don't know if your other caller was trying to repeat it, this meme that the American soldier is essentially a baby killer. Now, I'm not saying he said that. Please, I am not saying he said that. But there was an implication someone might get. That, you know, American soldiers are ordered to kill men, women, and children indiscriminately and don't have the right to, even if they are given such an order, don't have the right to disobey it. Ma'am, I fought on a demilitarized zone in an area known as Leatherneck Square, which is Contien, Quezon, Firebase Grant, Vandegrift, Firebase Charlie 2 and Alpha 4, and we were fighting North Vietnamese army troops who were dug in the bunkers and who fought like regular. It was more or less like World War II, the kind of fighting you would have seen in the, on the islands in the Pacific, in Peleliu, and in Saipan. So it was, we weren't fighting civilians. We weren't killing civilians. We were fighting soldiers. And when we killed them and searched their bodies, they had pay books indicating they were in the North Vietnamese Army. They had identification cards. They were carrying web gear, rucksacks, AK-47s with spare magazines and everything
else.
So, and I mean, I really get tired of hearing. Wait a minute. Number two.
Hold on. Let me make this point.
Number two.
We can all sing together, but we can't talk together at the same time.
I understand, but one more thing, someone, then please, if I respectfully request to be allowed to say this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Contrary to what your other caller said, the American soldier, I'm talking about the American, particularly from the middle of the 19th century through to today, has kept more freedom from tyranny, more people from freedom from tyranny and oppression than any other soldier in the history of mankind. I will say that without qualification, without apology. I believe it, and I can cite to you chapter and verse as to why that is so.
And I totally agree.
Sir, I totally agree. May I ask your first name, sir?
You can call Frank.
Hi, Frank. First of all, let me say thank you for the service that you have given. Okay, I have a family full of soldiers, my father, my grandfather, uncles, all of them. And I know exactly, especially around that time, what war does. I know it. I've seen so many people go in happy and come out different people. And I do believe everything that you just said with regards to that time era, that it was more. I believe that the troops of that era was a lot more comprehensively patriotic going in.
Ma'am, 67 or 68% of the men who fought, particularly who fought, who were actually in combat units with the mission to close with, engage, and destroy the enemy, over almost 70% of them were volunteers.
Right.
So this idea that the war in Vietnam was fought by draftees is a myth. I'm a black man, by the way.
That's a lie.
Talk about what I went through with my white comrades and others and my black brothers. It is a lie, another lie they try to tell about Vietnam, that black men disproportionately died there. That is not true. That is another lie they say to try to, you know, deconstruct the United States and its effort in Vietnam, which was flawed, which was not perfect, which did do some harm, but which was essentially a noble cause to stop one sovereign nation from invading another and wanted to impose a communist tyranny on them. Believe me, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were not good guys either.
Well, let me say something, and you're right about that. But according to the issue that I've learned, the United States came in after the French. Now, I wasn't painting anyone with a broad brush of being murderers. I'm just saying what a brother told me when he was in Vietnam. Now, the Vietnam War, but you need to go reassess that and recognize what really the fight was about. Because, like I said, the French was there and the British was there. The United States came in afterwards, and they are left there. For what reason, I cannot tell me. Let me finish speaking. I'm going to hit it and quit on this letter right here. Now, you're telling me about the North and the South wasn't good with each other. Well, you know, when are we going to stop our sons from killing each other here? How can I be more patriotic for somebody else's country, but I can't stop my children here from killing each other? I think that's, we got to back up,
Sir, first of all, look, a nation can walk and chew gum at the same time. You can have a foreign policy, and they can do things on the domestic level to stop children from killing each other. The two are not mutually incompatible.
We ain't doing it, though. We're putting guns and weapons in our hand to go to another country to kill or maybe be killed to stop somebody else from fighting.
Yes, I can't stop my own son from
fighting his brother across the
nation,
right next door. I ain't got got nothing to do with Afghanistan. Don't tell me I'm fighting for my country in Afghanistan and I'm living in the United States.
Sir,
you're lying
again,
to me. That's technology.
Sir, a nation can
and,
walk
and,
in
and
two guns at the same time.
Gentlemen.
Can you let the gentleman finish his point that has experienced this Vietnam thing and let him explain to you? Because he's trying to explain to you, but you won't let him get a word in edgewise.
Okay,
again, sir, the reason. Now, I know you may have been listening, and I don't know who you're listening to, but I know I studied the Iraq War extensively. Right now I'm reading a book called The Surge by Peter Mansour, who spent time with David Petraeus in Iraq, which, you know, all those Democrats and the liberals and others said the surge wouldn't work. Barack Obama got there telling us how the surge wouldn't work, and he couldn't possibly defeat the insurgency by the sort of tactics that David Petraeus wanted. Well, I got news for him. It did work, and it worked very well, and they effectively ended the insurgency from the time the Americans were in Iraq and enabled al-Maliki and the Iranian party to come to power and govern the country as they are now. Not perfectly, but they're at least governing. Now, when all these people told us the reason we went to Vietnam, Iraq and Afghanistan, the reason we went there was because of weapons of mass destruction. Well, they didn't read the Iraq War Resolution, which Congress voted on, overwhelmingly approved, when George Bush asked for war powers to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. 23 paragraphs, sir. 23. Only two of them mention weapons of mass destruction. It lays out the reason for the United States going there, most of which have to do with Saddam Hussein, number one, violating the United Nations Security Resolution, which he was bound to obey by the virtue of the armistice which he had signed, which we were a signatory to, and by the fact that he was firing on United Nations forces and had kicked United Nations inspectors out of Iraq. Another dictator named Adolf Hitler, he defied a little thing called an armistice, the Treaty of Versailles, in 1935, when he sent his soldiers in to the French, the German-French Rhineland to occupy the Rhineland in violation of the Treaty of Versailles. You know what people said then? Well, it's just an armistice. Who cares? It used to be part of Germany. Let's just let them do it. And then he went on. He started up a Luftwaffe because, you know, the armistice said Germans can't have an air force. And they said, well, it's not bothered. Who wants to go to war over that? Then he started up conscription. And everybody said, well, that's German affairs, all in their borders. We don't want to bother with it. Who wants to start a war over that? And then he invaded Austria, and he took over Austria and the Anschluss. Well, they're all German-speaking people. Who cares about that? Let him do what he's going to do. And you know what? We had World War II and 50 million people died. Well, I got news for you. Yeah. George Bush stopped Saddam Hussein, who modeled the Ba'ath Party after the Nazi Party, who admired Adolf Hitler, who said, in fact, he wanted to be a Napoleon of the Middle East and unite the Middle East, much as Hitler wanted to unite Europe under the Nazi banner. And I got news here. I think George Bush stopped that from happening in the bud, because this guy violated an armistice, which he was bound to obey by the fact he signed. We held him to the armistice and enforced regime change, which, by the way, was the official policy of the United States government by legislation made during the Clinton administration. Openly,
you know,
with debate.
Mr. Frank, I want to interject on one thing that you said. I agree that George Bush stopped Hussein. The only problem I had with it was that when they deployed the troops to go over there, it was with the strict order to look for Osama bin Laden, and it didn't seem like they really.
No,
went
ma'am,
after
it
Osama.
Wasn't. That's not true. That's not true. It wasn't.
They
were looking for him in Afghanistan, not in Iraq. They were looking for Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Right, but when he said that I would not even begin to perceive to understand military playbook whatsoever. So that's why I'm speaking from, like I said, I'm a mom of a soldier out there. I'm an aunt of a soldier, and frankly, I don't like war. Period. But
Oh, who does?
When he was making the announcement, it wasn't Saddam Hussein that he said they were going after in the beginning. I understood it. Everybody understood it to be that after the 9-1-1 attacks and then first and subsequent threats by being made by Osama by video, he said it was time to go find him. But they wind up getting Saddam. I think that's what made me angry about the war. So much about that war. So many of those kids came back so messed up, and it didn't seem like they even really knew which way they were going, just wind up something happened. But
yes, ma'am.
I will say from you, Frank, I got the answer that you believe that the era in which you fought, those troops did more understand political talks from a more comprehensive angle. Do you agree?
Well, look, many of us were like, when I was over there, I was a 20-year-old buck sergeant, okay? 20 years old, you know, politics wasn't particularly my bag. I was satisfied that the essential reason that I was over there fighting was essentially good. I had a lot of complaints about the way we were fighting the war, the way it was being managed, the way veterans were being treated and all of that. That didn't have anything to do with why we were there in the first place, I didn't think. And so, you know, I mean, all those issues are like separate issues. The typical GI wasn't particularly concerned too much about the policy except getting his behind back home in one piece when his tour duty was up. Some guys didn't want to get out of there like me. I extended my tour duty because I didn't want to leave my buddies. We were tight, and we figured
right.
If we stayed together, ones who came along behind me, we could all get out together. I was young. I was stupid. These were my homies. I was tight with them. They were my brothers in arms. Now, that didn't mean I loved them all the time. Sometimes we couldn't stand each other. And, like, I don't know about you and your brothers, but I used to fight with my brothers, and sometimes I used to fight with them. But bottom line, I loved them. I would risk my life for them, and they did for me. And that's what made me tight with them. And that's why I figured I couldn't leave some of them when my tour duty's up, so I extended my tour duty. That's the reason why. I just felt too close to them. I didn't want to leave them. And, you know, and that's the way it is with a lot of guys. They're over there to fighting for their buddies. Because these guys you're tight with, these guys you rely on, these guys who will put their lives on the line, and in fact have had. And not just putting your life on the line. It's like when you're sick with malaria. My outfit had a rule saying no one gets out of the field unless your temperature. We had so much malaria running through our battalion. You couldn't get out of the bush unless your temp was over 100 degrees. Unless you had a temperature over 100 degrees, you couldn't get out of the field. So you'd be sitting up there at night, shivering, shaking. You got the chills, you got the fever. The quinine, I mean the Adderall ain't working. And that other stuff they get, I forget what it is right now, another pill you had to take. It ain't working. So your buddy's up there sharing his fruit cocktail with you, and everybody loved the fruit cocktail. They didn't want to give it up. But he knows you need it because, you know, you got the shakes, and you got the diarrhea, and you got everything else, and you got to stay up all night on doing your turn-on watch, and you're sick. And he's talking, you're going to be okay, man. It's going to be all right. Here, take some of my fruit cocktail. You know. I'll take a couple hours of your watch. It's cool. You go to sleep, man. You need it. This kind of thing. You don't forget this. And that's what kept us together, and that's why we took out for each other. Maybe a guy takes a little bit of your weight. You know, a rucksack you're carrying out is 85, 90 pounds, typical infantry load. You're carrying 85, 90 pounds on your back, 100-degree humidity, 100-degree temperature, 100% humidity. You know, you're sick. You've been out in the bush for 3 weeks at a time, and you got to carry extra. Let me take your mortar rounds. I'll take two mortar rounds you're carrying. Maybe I'll take belts of M60 ammo, too. Take some of the load off your back. You don't forget these kind of things. Little things and big things, and when they all add up together, these are people you do not forget and you will die for if you have to. And that's what most of them were thinking about, watching out for each other and taking care of each other, and that's what we did. And I'm telling you, if you'd have seen these kids out there, you'd have said these kids are more noble than mostly any people you will ever know.
Yeah.
I mean, you see some 19-year-old kid who just went to Sam Houston School to be a medic. He's doing a tracheotomy on a guy. He's had his jaw blown off. And he's up there doing a tracheotomy on him, and he's 19 or 20 years old. And he saves the guy's life. And this wasn't uncommon. This kind of things happen over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Over and over again.
Frank, let me ask you a question, because I've spoken with the other panelists about this particular question. Now, like I said before, if you were listening in, I have no problem with needing a homeland, you know, security or defense. I don't have any problem with that. My problem has only been with the way the kids are being drawn in by these commercials nowadays. What do you think about that?
Look, I'll tell people the truth about at least my truth. My understanding, look, I don't claim to speak for all soldiers and all of their troops and all of their experience. I can only speak for mine, and mine was fairly typical of an infantryman and an armored crewman in Vietnam and in the first Gulf War, and my extensive studying of what's going on today in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think I can speak to that. And I can tell you this much. The armed forces have got to get people in it. And they're going to do what they're going to do to make it attractive to enlist. You think they're going to tell people about what a body smells like when it's been lying out in the sun for 3 or 4 days?
My Lord.
Oh, you
got
to get up there on top of a hilltop, and you got to start searching bodies for intelligence information, and you're going through their guts and their brains as you search their bodies to get map overlays and pay books and diaries and this kind of stuff. You think they're going to tell people about that? No. They're going to tell you about the challenges, which is true. Because, believe me, I went through, before I went overseas, I went through basic training. I went to armor advanced training. Then I went to armor non-commissioned officer school. Then I went to ranger school. Then I went to jump school. Well, I went to jump school before I went to ranger school. Then I went to ranger school. Then I went to assistant artillery forward observer school. And before I went overseas to Vietnam, I had about 13 months of training. It was hard training. It was challenging. Boy, was I proud to make it through. You know, that's true. Did that challenge, that outward bound stuff? Yeah, it's true. But let me tell you another thing, too. Combat is like a marathon. It's like grueling. It's like some of the most torturous stuff you could ever imagine. You're lucky to get 3 hours of sleep a day uninterrupted. Yeah. And that's lucky. And you're usually snatching it in half hour, 40-minute snatches at a time. You're constantly exhausted. You're constantly being sent on missions. Because remember, I'm a squad leader, so I'm getting called up by a platoon leader. Hey, get you guys ready for an ambush patrol. Get you guys ready for a recon patrol. Get you guys ready to saddle up. We're going to do an assault on that hill. Whatever. And you're constantly, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
You see things you will not believe. You smell things you will not believe. You got dysentery. You got diarrhea. You got brush fever. You got dengue. You got every doggone thing you can imagine. You got malaria. You got every ailment you can imagine. And you're carrying 90 pounds on your back, and you're sick, and you're tired. And your buddies are getting killed and wounded.
So, look,
if you don't tell them that, a lot of people wouldn't enlist. But you know what? That's part of it, too. And, you know, I don't blame the military for doing it, because, look, the most important single function, not that it's the only important function, but the most important single function of the United States federal government is to maintain an armed forces, one that's adequate, one, to protect us, and two, to protect our legitimate foreign policy interests and national defense interests. And that's the most important function, not Obamacare. Not, you know, Department of Education, student loans. It's to maintain that armed forces. And whatever they got to do to get the people in there, I say more power to them. Let them do it. Even if they got to kind of fudge it a little bit and maybe exaggerate the glory of it a little bit, fine. They'll find out the truth, and they can talk to veterans like me. And believe me, I'll tell them the truth. It's all of it's there. Some glory is there. There's some there is some glory there. There's nobility. You will see courage. You will see people do things you could not believe. And for me, that was the most important part of my life, seeing people do things that were almost superhuman. Ordinary people. Ordinary men. Doing things that were almost superhuman.
Can I ask you a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Sir? Now, I've already come to a conclusion on what I thought about this. And today, do you think that the United States government should bring back the draft?
They don't need to right now. We've got an armed forces that is very small. They don't have a chance of making it large. Look, a draft is for a time of total mobilization. We haven't had such a time and such a necessity since the Vietnam War and before that World War II. Because, look, you got your army, you're not going to keep it over a million people. You got a population base of 300 million people, of which there are more than enough eligible people in the armed who want to join the armed forces. So a draft is not necessary. A draft is needed for times of total mobilization like the Second World War. We don't need that right now. Frankly, it ain't necessary. It isn't necessary.
You know why I asked that? Because for the simple fact, like, remember when we were coming up, when you went through school, you graduated from high school, you either had a choice, you go to college, or you would go to the military.
Yep,
those
absolutely
were your choices.
I remember everybody served.
But now,
Frank,
but see, the problem I have is
1 second, Frank.
The problem that I have is that these young people that we have now in today's society, when they get out of high school,
we're losing you, Deacon. Speaking of far.
Hello?
Hello? Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, the problem that I have is a lot of them are getting out of school. A lot of them don't have any thought of going to college. They just want to be out here and hanging out in the streets. And that, to me, is a problem because we're not giving them much of a choice, and they figure, well, I'm done with school. I'll sit out a year and go to college. I'll go to college next year, and next year never get to it. That's why I'm saying if there was another choice, and a lot of them, they get in trouble. They think they're tough. Okay, if you think you're tough, you're hard, you're a big bad boy, okay, let's go see if you can stand up. Go into the military. Sign yourself in the military or something. Because
yeah, but
right
Deacon,
now that's... Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead, sir.
Go ahead.
But Deacon, look, I don't think the policy of the armed forces, if an incidental function of the armed forces is to serve a positive social engineering, good. Because for me it was positive. On the aggregate,
right.
Despite the negative things I had, experience I had in the armed forces, for me, overall, it was positive. It made me a better human being, a better man in total. However, I don't think that's why we should have an armed forces. The purpose of the armed forces is to close with, engage, and destroy the enemy when it's necessary, protect the national security, protect our borders. I don't think we need to have the armed forces enforce social policy. Yes, the young man you speak of, make them aware of the opportunities and what's available for them in the armed forces should they choose to design. But we should not design the armed forces for purposes of social engineering. That's the problem with the Obama administration, what they're trying to do right now with our armed forces. I'm totally against that sort of thing. Absolutely against it. And no, I don't think we should have an armed force for the purpose of social engineering. And I do think being service in the armed forces makes you, in the main, for the vast majority of veterans, a better person. That doesn't mean that's why we need to have it, so young youths will be kept from being wayward. Hell, before that happened, we didn't have youths and all the kind of trouble they're in now, and we didn't have a draft in the 1930s, and we didn't have these kind of crazy acting youths we got today.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I was a young man back in the 70s to where I was labeled a menace to society. And I was looking at 10 to 15 years in the penitentiary, but a judge saw something in me that I didn't realize that I had in me and gave me a choice. Or do 3 years in the military or go do these 10 to 15 years. And I thought I was one of the toughest Brooklyn boys you ever want to meet. But I found out that that wasn't so. And I wind up being sent to the military, but I didn't realize he had already made arrangements and they were waiting for me when I got in there. But my attitude towards life before I went into the military was negative. Negative. And the experience that I had going through the training and dealing with my drill sergeants and officers there in the military made me have a different outlook on life, period. And as far as my attitude, it changed all of that. You know, and I looked at it like...
It's the job for most people because most people, as you correctly note, are positively influenced by their military service, even those who hated it. And many people who served, especially during the draft, hated being in the armed forces. But when they got out and looked back on it, they say overall, I say most, not all, most will say it was a positive experience. And as I said, if that's an incidental, a peripheral result of service in the armed forces and making young men who, like you, were given a choice, I say, yeah, that's good. But that's not the reason to create a draft. The reason for creating a draft would be is if we need the manpower, or should I say people power, in the event of a total mobilization or a very large mobilization. Absent that, no. There's no reason to have a draft.
Frank and Deacon, I have to get over to another panelist in just a minute. I agree with you wholeheartedly, Frank. It's like parents using school for babysitters, okay? Without just getting involved with their children's homework. Okay, I get that. I believe that 100%. I do believe that the Army has its perks, its benefits for, like you said, one of the reasons why you went in, Deacon, was because a judge mandated you to go and you got a good experience out of it. I agree with you, Frank, stating that the Army is not the social engineering backup plan. And frankly, I don't think today's youth should be using the Army as a fallback plan either. Get out there and work your butts off in school and do what you have to do. And then if the Army is something that you can make a sound decision into wanting to go into, yes, but I think that people like you, Deacon, and you, Frank, should be the people who recruit these kids. Why? Because you do have the experience of talking about what they need to know when they get in there so that they can have a fully comprehensive choice on the table. That's what I think. Let's go to our other panelists for just a minute, okay? Lady Diamond, are you there? Hello? Okay, she's on. When she chimes in, it's her turn. I agree. One of the things I can say, gentlemen, I'm not an Army brat to the point where I've moved around from station to station. I don't know anything about that. But I do know all of my uncles, my grandfather, my father, my cousins, everyone that went in your era, in the 70s, going even up to even the 80s, okay, when they spoke about Vietnam, when they spoke about World War II, when they spoke about all the things that used to happen, okay, the way that they come back, those that didn't go PTSD completely or the coming out of the Army didn't destroy them, they had great things to say, looking back, like you said, Frank, and saying that it made me a better person. It taught me how to be organized. It taught me discipline. It taught me honor. They had honor going in. Nowadays, when I'm hearing these kids talk about enlisting, it's for the money. It's for the being able to shoot up one of those wigs over there. Right, the racism is horrible. It's not about defending the country anymore. It's about going in there to get something they can't get here. Then they go in not understanding what they're up against. Like I spoke about earlier on, they can go in and see that their best friend or their buddy get blown up before they even make it out of training. What does that do to them? And then lately, some of the things that's been happening when the soldiers return home by the U.S. government themselves is another problem that I have. I don't think that when you guys come from doing a tour, serving as surviving a war, you should have any type of background checks to go through to get a house, to get a mortgage, to get a car, nothing. I think whatever it is that normally if you didn't go to war, you'd have to go through some criteria should be exempt for you guys. I really do. I think any medical things that you need, that there should be some provision in all funds in the government to have you guys covered. I don't think you should have to go through anything that we went through because nobody in their right mind, in their choice of jobs, would get up and say, I want to go in a foreign land and shoot people up to defend my country. But all of you did. All of you go out there every day. And like you said, Frank, you form some new families and brotherhoods because that's all, you guys are all you have out there. You're in a foreign land.
Yes, ma'am. You know, look, I like what you had to say a moment ago, that you should, but I don't think anybody should be exempt from reasonable background checks for loans and things like that, because after all, people are putting their money.
No, I think if it's a veterans program, there should be a veterans program. If they know what your DD-19 form said when you got released, they know you served. You shouldn't have to prove that you served.
There's a lot of fraud out there, too. I mean, look, we don't want people who are fraudulently claiming to be veterans able to claim the. I mean, look, all I ask is that everything be reasonable and that once all the identity and everything else is established, then the person be honored for their services. I don't think that being a veteran, even an honorably served veteran, even a highly decorated honorably served veteran should be exempt from the normal rigorousness of citizenship. I think citizenship is something that is essentially universal. Yes, you give them a couple, okay, for application for like federal employment, and if states want to give you extra points toward employment over and above the normal criteria, okay, that sort of thing, fine. Veterans home loans, fine. GI Bill, fine. All that sort of thing, great. But look, I don't think we should make a cult out of veterans anymore than we do anybody else. Particularly like
this
guy in the White House. I mean, you know, where people just form a cult around him and don't hold him to the normal sort of standards. I think everybody, even veterans, should be essentially held to the same sort of standards all citizens are, acknowledging the fact that probably the most rigorous thing a nation can ask of a citizen is to serve in its armed forces even during peacetime, to say nothing of a war. and say nothing of combat in a war. So, yeah, but I just want to put a little caveat on that. You know, when we're talking about what sort of privileges or perks we give the veterans. Yes, I don't think any citizens earn their privileges more than honorably serving veterans, whether they served in combat or not. Because believe me, to be ready to go, to answer the call, whether it's peacetime, whether you're serving in Alaska, whether you're a supply clerk in Hawaii, I don't care. As long as you serve honorably, you are an important part of the defense machine. All of it is
Absolutely.
Necessary. Every bit.
And I do want to clarify that I meant you guys should not, once you show your documents, and I'm not talking about just walking up and dressed in camouflage and telling a bank that you were a vet. Don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about once your Social Security number hits that computer, once you show your discharge forms, once you have been established, you should have not to go through anything else. I have seen people going that were veterans to applying for veterans home loans, and for whatever banking issue, political cut, whatever it is, they had to go through credit checks and proving income. Are you kidding me? I mean, listen, I commend you as a soldier for saying that, the things that you say, and, you know, I wouldn't be that forgiving to a country I've served, especially if I've come back and I can't work anymore.
Well, ma'am, I don't understand how it is you can expect a business, a person's a lousy credit risk, even if he's a veteran, you know, they shouldn't be forced to give them a loan. I mean, if they have objective evidence that they really are terrible credit risk, you're not going to pay the loan back, and the bank's going to be out of money. I don't think they should be obligated to make the loan. Look, Artie Murphy is one of the greatest heroes this country has ever seen. I mean, this guy did things.
Hello?
If you read his
Hello?
Book, No Name on the Bullet, which I read, or any of the other works about Artie Murphy, you would not believe the experiences that man went through.
Yeah.
But believe me,
yeah.
he was a lousy credit
True.
Risk. And if I was sitting
yes,
at a bank
was.
With an obligation to a board of directors, I wouldn't give him a loan. I mean, he's a great man. I might give him my own personal money out of gratitude for his incredible service to this country, his beyond belief service to this country. I might encourage others to take up a collection for him and all that sort of thing, but I would never give him a loan through the auspices of the bank.
Right.
Okay, there's a little bit of a static. I don't know where it's coming from. But, you know, I kind of lost a little bit of what you said at the end there, Frank.
Sadie?
Yeah, I can hear you. I can hear all of you.
You hear
okay.
me?
Yes, I can hear you. All right, Elaine, what do you have to
say? Yeah, let me say something, you know. Myself, I'm adding it since I answered the question like earlier that you asked. I feel that most of the people today, they are under... They're being misguided on joining certain groups, you know, Army, Marines, Air Force. They're under a certain pressure that, yes, I mean, some will go in, oh, yes, this could have paid for my college tuition, yada, yada, yada. And they forget the part of you're going in to, you know, defend your country. And, like, I was hearing, and I was like, you know, it brought back, like, the time when I was 18, like I said, you know, I was joining the Marines. And then I took the exam and everything. I was ready to go on and leave. Because I was ready to defend my country. I wanted to fight, which is crazy as I am. Yes, I wanted to fight. I wanted to fight for my country. I wanted to fight for everything. I didn't care how the hell I came back. You know what I'm saying? You know, I'm old enough to say it now. But when I was 18, I didn't care how I came back. But I wanted to come back knowing that I did the best I can to defend, you know, what I believed in. You know, that's what I wanted. I didn't get a chance to do it because, like, you know, my grandmother passed away. And I got held back a lot. Then I said, you know what, I had to say that. I got depressed and then went to college and continued from there. But I still go back to the point of my cousin, he joined the Marines. My daughter's uncle was in the Marines also, and that was influencing me to join it, you know. That was influencing me because my cousin, he was a sharpshooter, and I wanted to do that. I wanted to do what he did. So that influenced me. I said, you know what, I want to go and protect my country. I want to go out there, and if someone tries to take my, you know, to try to burn my flag down, I'm there to defend my flag. I'm there to see all these soldiers. I'm there to see the people's bodies get blown up. I was ready. I wanted to be ready to get in that. That's how, you know, that's how I felt. You know, I still feel the same way. I still look back, I'm like, damn, I wish I had the chance to get in this. You know, but right now, I think right now, I probably would have been an officer. I probably would have been going on my pension right now, you know. I probably would have been, you know, doing a little bit different than what I'm doing right now. That's how I feel. Compared to, like, the college kids, the teens today, they don't see it that way. They see it, like, what I overheard, that it's either college or just hang out. And they choose to hang out over college. These the recruits do go into the colleges, and the recruits do go into the high schools, but they don't actually put in the effort and saying, listen, this is what is done. Yet you will get some type of college reimbursement or college tuition being covered for your participation, but this is what you're actually doing. If we go into war, you are being called in. And that's what they don't put out there. It's like seeing the recruits, they're sitting there, oh yeah, join us, you get college funded. Oh yeah, join us. That's all they're saying. You don't hear nothing about them saying, you join us, you are on call. You are on call soon after.
Indeed. That's what I say, and I try to educate these young kids, not because I have any type of first-hand military experience, but based on the people that I have seen come home from war, like I said, grandfathers, fathers, aunts, uncles, people that have come back, the honor that's in their eyes when they've completed it, some of them that have gone in the opposite direction for the negative, the change in their behavior, but the things that they suffer, and some of it is code of honor where they have to keep it to themselves and it's just experiences they could never share with their family, but they deal with the demons of it. These are things that I hate to see young kids thinking that life or war is like the movies that you see. The movies, mm-hmm. a two-hour feature film that at the end the hero comes out walking. You understand? He lost one of his
wings and he comes out walking.
But there are three very seasoned and decorated soldiers sitting here on this panel right now. Frank, you said a mouthful tonight. Deacon, you and I have had plenty of discussions about it on and off the air. I've talked to my father. I've seen uncles start drinking over what they've come back with and never turn back to being the people they used to be. So I don't find war to be something that should be glamorized. I don't think that young kids that have barely come out of their junior year in high school should be already being approached by a bunch of people who you said not to make a call out of it, Frank. The way that they have these young kids right now, these young recruiters for the reserve, dressed up in their camouflage with their berets and their combat boots in groups, walking the streets, telling these young kids what a great honor it is to be, you know, to go to war, to just be in there. But the first thing they talk about is the money that these kids are going to get. I can't stand that part because I haven't seen my father, uncles, grandfather, et cetera, come back from the real war, from what it really means to be in war. It makes what they're doing seem like a movie.
Well, ma'am, I hate to tell you this, and I really do, because, you know, we're talking about, as you just pointed out, very young, impressionable people at the beginning of the promise of their young lives. You know, when you get out of high school, I mean, that's when you got the most promise and future ahead of you. But I hate to tell you this, but this is the truth, having been there myself and witnessing, the best infantry you're going to get are people about that age, young men about that age. Not only are they in the peak of their recuperative power, and believe me, you got to have it to be a grunt. You better believe it. And
you
know, you might
it.
Get stronger. You might get physically stronger when you're older. The one thing you got when you're young is the ability to recuperate. And nobody's better at that than an 18-year-old male. And when the armed forces understands this, this is why they go after them so heavily. They are the best infantry. Now, it's unfortunate they have to get used up like that, but it's just the truth. So the armed forces understands what that is. We're talking about lower-ranking people. I'm talking about the lower-rank, people at the platoon and company level. You want 18, 19, 20-year-olds. That's who you want to get. So the thing of it is, though, is it would be nice if the armed forces could figure out a way to minimize the harm done to the young, impressionable minds. Believe me, I understand you in that respect. I am in complete accordance with you in that respect, but there's this tension here with what the armed forces needs and with what is best for an individual human being. And unfortunately, since war kills thousands, I mean, we're talking now about how many people getting killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, even during my time in Vietnam, 58,000. But look,
right,
during World War II, people talk about how easy, and this is true, in historical sense, it is absolutely true. The United States got off real easy considering in its human toll, given it was involved in a global war on two fronts against the most formidable enemies this country has ever had to face, the Germans and the Japanese. Now, we lost in that war, and really the peak of engagement of the United States Armed Forces in that war didn't start until about the winter of 1943 and didn't really go into high gear until the invasion of Normandy, both for the Pacific and in Europe. And despite that, despite people saying the United States got off easy, we had 410,000, listen to me again, 410,000 people who died in the line of duty in the armed forces of the United States during the Second World War. That's how many,
yeah,
people, and many of them, if not maybe the slight majority of them, were 18, 19, 20 years old, under 25 years of age. So, I mean, you know, that's what war does. It uses up people and spits them out like they're going through a meat grinder. And
well,
there's no way to get around it. There's no way. There was no way they could have been fighting that war, sending those men up in those bomber crews in the 8th Air Force, getting shot down before they completed 15 missions. The tour of duty was 25 missions. The odds were you're going to be dead, wounded, or prisoner of war before you completed 15 missions. And these guys had to keep going up day after day after day, knowing more likely than not they were going to get shot down. They didn't even have a decent fighter escort to get them to the target and back. And the same thing along with infantry going into some of these units and after the,
yeah,
invasion of Normandy and fighting in the Hurtgen Forest, fighting in the Battle of the Bulge, fighting in the hedgerows getting out of Normandy, fighting on those Pacific islands. Good God, the attrition rate in some of the units were 150%. I'm talking about a complete one-and-a-half times turnover. In the 36th Infantry Division, it was 180% killed and wounded from the Salerno invasion in 1943 to the end of the war. 180% rate turnover. This wasn't atypical.
That's why they call it war.
Yeah. So,
well,
you know, so when you say this,
that,
when you say this, that, you know, okay, young people, they shouldn't be. Well, if they were, you might not get enough of them.
Well,
and we wouldn't win the war, we have
either
to have. Or we wouldn't be able to do the war, we've got to fight.
All right. Let me make this point. Thank you. Let me tell you this, sir. You said something not 8 minutes ago that would probably be one hell of a big change. You said that you wish there was a way they could minimize the damage done to some of these young people. And I'm going to tell you something. When they come up to these schools, and mind you, you're saying the 18-year-olds, they're coming to these children before they even end their senior year in high school, recruiting, putting the option out there, like, you know, yes, and this is a place to go. Let me tell you something. If they had true soldiers going in, not just the ones that are out there as salesmen for the reserve, because let me tell you something. I haven't seen not one true soldier that's in those recruiting things. I've seen it. My son just turned 16. They already tried to approach him in a mall when he was 15 years old. Okay? I have seen them come up there, and not one of them could even talk about having completed a tour in any branch of the military. They are simply reserve kids, just like the ones they're trying to bring in. So guess what? If they want to come in on career day and recruit these kids, because like you said, we need manpower. We definitely need them young and able-bodied and able to recuperate, absolutely. So bring in Deacon Zeddy Williams and yourself, people like you, to stand right there with those same recruiting people and talk about what happened and tell them about the greatness of war and being in the military. But at the same time, tell them, look, it's a great thing to do. You'll get honor out of it. You could become a better person. You'll learn a lot of discipline. But you know what? It's not the commercials. And I can guarantee you that those children you still get that will go and sign up anyway, at least they're more informed and they know what to expect.
Now you know, I got to agree with you there, ma'am. Because, look, I couldn't be a recruiter because I have to tell them the truth. I just couldn't do it.
Yes.
I just could not lie. I could not do it. I'm telling you right now. They asked me, look, what's the worst thing you went through? I tell them about Hill 175 on Gallagher's Ridge. We got almost overrun by a battalion of North Vietnamese and looking on that hill the next day, and I look at all those dead North Vietnamese soldiers on that hill, chewed to pieces by Spectre gunships, artillery fire, tank guns firing canister, point-blank range, and interlocking bands of machine gun firing, claymore mines going off in their face. I couldn't believe the carnage I saw. It's the worst thing I ever saw in my life. I'd have to tell them about that. They asked me what was the worst moment I ever saw. That's it. 175 dead NV on top of a hilltop. You know, but hey, you know, but look, that's why I couldn't be a recruiter. They probably wouldn't. If like I got the job, they kicked me out if they heard what I told them.
You know something? Maybe they should stop. This is not. They should stop treating this like it's a new vacuum they're trying to sell. And maybe they should recruit properly. Okay, not a bait and switch. Because if this was a product, America would be calling it a bait and switch trap, and it would be considered fraud. This is people's lives you're talking about. People's brains and the way they think. How much PTSD is going on right now that's not being cared for?
But it's not so much fraud as it is, well, maybe fraud in the omission, perhaps, the things they omit.
No, it's a bait and switch.
Is what it is.
Absolutely.
I don't think any of them willfully tell them that if they're asked, oh, it's combat rough, or, you know, because, Frank, I got to admit, the training I went through in Ranger School, was, except for the shooting, was just about as grueling as combat. And that's why it was such excellent training, because it really got you ready for combat, especially to function without sleep, to go through mission after mission without any sleep. But, you know, look, and they're going to tell you about that. They're pretty straight about that sort of thing. It's about combat they kind of leave out a lot of details about and what they expect of you and what the Uniform Code of Military Justice can do to you if you don't do what you're obligated to do under that document.
Yeah.
That's what they don't tell them about. And and that's what, you know, I would sit there and tell them, look, you don't have the same rights in the armed forces that you do as a civilian. Your rights come entirely from the Uniform Code of Military Justice, not from the Constitution, the Constitution gives Congress the right to make rules for the armed forces. But since they do, you are then governed by that document. And you don't have the right of free speech. It's amazing to think about this, seeing you in the armed forces, and you have you get hands-on of the most deadly weapons on the planet, but you don't even have the right to keep and bear arms.
That's right.
You have the right to keep bonds when they tell you you do. You don't have the right to free speech. You don't have the right to free association. You don't have any of those rights. Your company commander may be an idiot. He may be the stupidest fool you ever seen. But you get up in the mess and say, my company commander is an idiot and he's utterly incompetent. You can be charged with insubordination, disrespect to superior officers, even if it's the truth.
Yes.
if it's the truth. You don't have the right to free speech. And not only in civilian life, you might only be fired, but in the armed forces, they'll put you in the stockade.
So
you don't have the same rights. They don't make that clear to a lot of people. You can't withdraw your labor at will.
All that comes out of your mouth is yes, sir, and no, sir.
Yeah, you can't withdraw your labor at will, and this is the biggest thing about it. Even though American soldier has been executed for a strictly military offense since Private Eddie Slovic in the Second World War.
Yeah.
That was the last one.
Yeah.
He's the only one that got it. All those people deserted during the war, even under fire and everywhere else. He's the only guy who got executed because he wrote a letter saying he wouldn't go back to combat and he had deserted. That's the only reason he got executed. But they can, if the circumstances are right, they can execute you for not obeying orders, particularly under fire, or engaging in an act of mutiny or anything else. There's no comparable thing that can happen to you in civilian life. They don't tell them about that either.
That's right.
I wish they would, you know, I wish they'd tell them just about the legal things they're going to be under. You know, the fact that being in the armed forces, anybody tries to compare being in the armed forces to being any aspect of civilian life, even in peacetime, is just, that is one of the biggest hokums I've ever. It's not a job like any other. Anybody says, well, in civilian life they do this. No. They didn't have even said, you know, the armed forces is not subject to the same rules everything else is. If you got military leaders who get you killed unnecessarily or stupidly, there's a little thing the Supreme Court made a ruling called the Ferris Doctrine. That's F-E-R-E-S.
Yes.
Look it up.
Yes.
The government is essentially immune to being sued. You can show that your military leaders should have known that, for instance, like at Tarawa in 1943, there were neap tides and they needed Amtraks to get over the reefs, and that they were going to blow it if they didn't have them, and yet still they went ahead with the invasion anyway. They had to drop the ramp 800 yards out from the lagoon, and the Marines had to wade through the water because they didn't have the Amtraks that could crawl over the reefs. And what? Lo and behold, the Japanese machine gunners cut them to ribbons, killed 1,200 of them on almost the first day. The first day. And they should have known better. Same thing at Omaha Beach. Same thing in Hurricane Fort. Same thing with the self-defending bomber formations. On and on and on. Korea, Vietnam, you can show the same kind of mistakes. They've made them over and over again. You can't be sued. They can't sue you. And a lot of people don't seem to realize that either. I wish they'd be honest about that when they talk to these kids.
Yeah.
I believe so. I think that they should. Carla, I see you there. Just give me 1 minute. I believe that when they're going out there to talk to these children, these new, especially today's youth, okay, they need to be honest. Maybe not give them, you know, the you know, super gory version, but these hard facts need to go there. You can get hurt in training. You can hurt yourself. You might see things that's going to mess you up for life. Because this is the thing. They're going in there with their duffel bags all packed up, thinking they're going out there to hurt something and come back with just stripes and a soldier's badge. Okay? There's a lot more to it. I've seen happy-go-lucky jokesters leave to the Army and come back broken, angry men, paranoid men, alcoholics, lost everything, can't maintain relationships.
But for
I think the best thing about
learning what you're capable of, if you're a member of the armed force, is pulling up strengths you never knew you had or existed. You never knew you could do it, and you did it. And there is a measure of – that's the glory about war. That is the glory about war, and you do it in concert with your comrades. And remember, I'm talking about the white guys, the black guys, Hispanic guys, the Native American guys, all of them. Sometimes we couldn't stand each other. We'd fist fight because we didn't like each other all the time. Now, like I said, they were my brothers, and I don't know about you all, but I used to fight with my real brothers, and I used to fight with these brothers too. Okay,
Now
we just couldn't stand. Bottom line, when the bottom line would come to it, we would go to each other, and we could count on each other. And the ones that couldn't either would get killed because somebody would just let them get killed or wounded, or they got transferred out to other outfits. They didn't stay. The ones who tended to stay in the units were the guys who could nuke at least routinely count on. In that respect, they were your brothers. And that is the kind of thing
that
only combat and extreme stress forges. And believe me, that's the glory of being in the armed forces. That was the best thing for me about having been and served in the armed forces, knowing that actually can happen. I have experienced it. I'm a retired police officer. I'm a retired state policeman. And I spent 20 years in the National Guard after I got off active duty. I have not experienced anything like that. And I have some really good relationships with my police officer friends. We went through some periods of extreme danger, but nothing compared to what I went through as a young soldier in Vietnam. Nothing. And to my dying day, I remember the things I went through with those guys. And I'm grateful for them, and I love them to this day. To this day.
Amen.
And I think
Can I make a quick comment?
Zeddy, I was going to come to you now and then ask to take another caller.
Okay. I just want to make the comment. Please, don't try and be upset with these recruiters because they are trained to recruit. They are following orders. Like the gentleman said, it's totally different from military life and civilian life. So what they're doing is just following orders. They're trained to recruit. The way they recruit. So don't be upset with them because they're just following orders.
I call them military salesmen because their pitch is practiced. It's definitely something from a textbook. I've done sales quite a bit. Maybe not in military, but they're selling the military enlistment, and that's the way I see it. I still think no matter what, there's got to be in this particular respect, in this particular product, because that's what I'm going to call it, you need to have some truth because these people are going in to something that they've never experienced before. This is not their average schoolyard fight. This isn't the average news article about somebody that was kidnapped and was found. These are people they're going to see. It could be a child that looks as innocent as a beautiful flower that's carrying a bomb in their pocket. I understand that part. I've seen it. I've heard it. I've watched my family go down. I've watched soldiers come back. I've seen people that even come through the Madison Square Garden where I work talking about it from your time, gentlemen, talking about how the changes even in people's attitudes, how some of them feel like, my God, this is the country I defended. I understand that. I understand forming a brotherhood with a bunch of strangers because it's only you and those people in something like this. I understand that. Yeah, go ahead.
When you talk about the recruiting officers, you're not talking bad about them, but I agree with what you say because my recruiting officer gave me all the answers to the test that you would take at Fort, not Fort Dix, over here in Brooklyn. What's in that spot over there? You go to the test set, you get sworn in at.
A reception station?
I know it was over on the other side of Brooklyn. I forgot what called that unit, a spot over there, where you get sworn in at. I went over there and I was given the answers to the final test to get you in there. I was given by these recruiting officers. I was tricked into it.
No, they're not supposed to do that. They can get in trouble for that.
They told me how to cover it up and make sure I don't get busted. I was 17 or 18.
Well, they're not supposed to do that. They can get in trouble
for
that.
I'm telling you what happened.
I believe you.
About the recruiting office, I'm telling you what happened. Now, you don't have to believe it if you don't
want to. No, I believe you. I know what happened. I believe you. I believe you.
He says he believes you, but that, you know, they weren't supposed to do that. Gentlemen, I have to bring our other panelists in just a second.
Wow.
Welcome to the show, Colin. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm Tony. 6-year Marine veteran. I listen to most of the guys. Hey, how you doing, man? God bless you too.
All right.
All other vets that's on the segment here that I was listening to. I'm here in San Diego. Okay. Yes. Also, I was listening to what other people say. Everybody has a valid point. But also, when I was growing up, I was 17. I know I didn't want to stay home. My parents didn't have money for college. I wanted to do something different because I saw my other peers around me not doing anything, getting into trouble. I know I wanted to leave, so by my senior year, my mother didn't want me to go to the military, you know. And she said, no, go to college, do something else, work. And I'm like, I'm going to see the world. That was me at 17. So
right.
When I was 18, that was the best move I ever went. Now, everybody has different experiences. Everybody going to, you know, I experienced racism in the military also, you know. But looking at the time, back then, I see a lot of my friends got killed, dead. I'm like, man, where would I be? You can't do shoulda, coulda, woulda. And like I said,
right.
The guy that said he's a Vietnam veteran, I give him a lot of praise because the way the vets now are getting treated, the Vietnam veteran didn't get not even a third of what they're doing now. And now,
right.
You know, slowly but surely, you know, any VA, you have something medical, PTSD, go to the VA hospital. I mean, we can see faults in all types of things, but military is a job. It's a job. You go to your now. If you go to your job right now, that you're working at right now, if you go there and say, I'm on my feet on speech, okay, try that and see what happens. At any job, they want you to be productive at what you do. You're not there to, you know, make friends. You're there to work. Do your job. That's the bottom line. But like I said, everybody has a valid point on this segment. I listen to everyone. Everybody has a valid point. And I agree with the Vietnam veteran and the guy that's talking right now. I forgot his name. Anyway, this is his point also about different, you know, we all experience something different because
right.
In each unit, you know, United States, you know, you're talking millions of people in the military. Everybody's going to experience something different. Some people may fall through the cracks and may not get picked on, you know, or, you know, I've seen where I got disciplined because I just stood up for somebody and they put me on, you know, NJP, you know, non-judicial punishment. Also, this is punishment,
right.
You know, because I just spoke up with the truth.
Well, Article 15?
And when
15?
I request mass, you know.
Is that an Article 15?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
And, I mean, even that, you know, it was like a handful of black Marines in New Arizona on the Marine base, the air base. And you do a little thing, they want to kick you off the base. I'm like, are you serious? And then the white guys get popped on the piss test. You know all races get popped on the piss test, but the majority of white guys get popped on the piss test, get out honorable. And you're like, are you serious?
Yeah.
And a black guy had
a
$3 check on base, and they want to get him out other than I said, that's crazy. I couldn't believe it. But what can you do? You know, I was an E4 at the time, and, you know, officers, you know, I see some guys request masks, and they get them out back because you're going against the system. Now most things they want to handle in-house in the military, like the rape charges, they want to handle their own thing. Now, this one thing that pissed me off. I mean, not pissed off, kind of disappointed. Like, out of all the years, all the rape charges, the sexual harassment in the military, they get the only black commander in Japan to take the fall. And I was like, shocked.
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute. When it comes to sexual harassment and sexually oriented charges, they've been getting white commanding officers right and left. I've got a whole raft of information about that.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, it ain't just brothers they getting. I mean, you remember Tail Hook? It goes all. It really started with Tail Hook back in the mid '80s,
right.
And you had that other scandal with that female B-52 pilot, and the Air Force got a bad nose about that. And they've been having it is legion now. What's going on with the armed forces and sexual charges? And believe me, most of the officers getting charged are white.
Yeah.
Well, actually glad about that. I'm actually glad that they're getting stricter with that because, you know, even outside of the military, you know, that this type of charge used to be something that everybody either wanted to keep it in the closet. You remember back in the day it was like what goes on in this house stays in this house type thing. But they are becoming a little more serious about it. Frankly, one of the things I never understood is, especially back then when war was active, why on earth would anybody that's inside, behind the walls, okay, find the time to hate anybody that's in a uniform when all of you, come crunch time, have to have each other's back against the enemy?
Let me explain this to you if I can, and I hope this comes across the way I intended to.
You could explain human nature, I hope so, because that makes no sense to me.
Go ahead.
I was saying if you could explain that the lapse there in judgment and human nature under that circumstance, please do.
It's quite understandable, even though it's not forgivable. Look, you got to understand one thing about back in the day, it was common for soldiers to get the death penalty and have it carried out. I'm talking about within living memory, like during the Second World War. Hundreds of American soldiers were executed during the Second World War. Now, only one was executed for a military offense, but the others were executed for the very same thing they were being executed for in civilian life, murder and rape. When a soldier got convicted of rape of just about anyone, by court-martial or otherwise, they got the death penalty. Now, there's been recent studies to show, for instance, that during the Second World War, black soldiers were disproportionately convicted and executed for it, and there's some evidence to bear that out. Probably the most famous that you never knew, Emmett Till's father was executed during the Second World War for murdering and raping two Italian women in Italy. Now, when people were talking about his father, the NAACP managed to get it covered up that's what he was executed for. They said he died in the line of duty in France. But in reality, Emmett Till's father was executed for rape and murder of two Italian women in Italy. He had a very lengthy trial by standards of court-martial of the day. It was like 2 or 3 months. That's a long court-martial.
Yeah.
And they introduced a lot of evidence at the trial to show that he was more likely than not guilty. And having researched it, I'm pretty much satisfied it probably was a just decision, given the mores of the time. But the point I'm trying to make here is that it was common to execute soldiers for rape. However, we all know that just doesn't happen anymore. They haven't executed anybody in civilian life for rape since Carol Chessman in 1953, and he was a civilian. That was the last time anybody executed for rape in the United States.
Mr. Fink, I wanted to interrupt you for one reason. That's not the question that I was asking. I was asking how could the soldiers among themselves have any discrimination, you know, anything like that. You guys have to form a brotherhood, sisterhood, whatever it is, because you're standing on the line of duty to protect your land, protect each other. How on earth could y'all fight among each other, have a hatred for either color or gender or orientation or religion, when at the end of the day, all of you have to pull together to shoot the outsiders?
Because there's one thing we got to remember about the people in the armed forces. They are human beings. You got as many louses, roughly,
right,
or not as many, but I would say in the armed forces you got a lesser percentage of people who are criminally inclined than the civilians. There's still nonetheless a significant percentage who are just criminally inclined and are just bad people. And, you know, and when they have the opportunity to commit crime and do bad things, like any others, whether they wear a uniform or not, whether they have the obligation to behave honorably or not, they just aren't going to live up to what they're supposed to do. It's no different in the armed forces than it is anywhere else.
Correct.
Despite the attempts of the armed forces to make you and to mold you into overcoming your baser instincts. So we got to understand that normal factor of evil in human beings. Soldiers and others are just as susceptible to it as any others. It's the character of the individual that determines whether they will do it or not. Now, having said that, there is a culture within the armed forces that tends to, given the pressures on commanders, that tends to, when the complaints are legitimate, and believe me, not all the complaints are legitimate, but when they are, and there are examples of legitimate complaints of rape and sexual assault by members of, and this, by the way, more males are victims of sexual assault than are females. I'm talking about by other males.
Yes.
If you look at absolute numbers, more men report being sexually assaulted than women. But when you look
I believe that. I am not I'm not a sexist by any means. I do not believe that women are innocent of doing the very same thing that men do. I believe they're abusive women. There are rapists.
No, it's men who are abusing other men.
Men. Yeah.
Sexually abusing other men.
Yes.
Wow.
Because
I'm talking about of the total number of sexual assaults, many of them involve homosexual rape and assault.
Now,
but I'm talking about where the complaints are legitimate. There is a tendency of commanders to, if they think they can get away with it, and they're not supposed to do this either, they will cover it up for the sake of their careers and not getting a black mark on their record. Or you might get perhaps what they call unlawful command influence. Well, you have, because remember, judicial punishment and general court-martials, as a sexual assault or rape will be handled by a general court-martial, is under the command of a division commander. Directly.
Yeah, a lot of it was swept under the rug when I was in Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Yeah, and you know, and there's a tendency to do that too. But and there's also the fact that many of these complaints are just not legitimate. So you got you got legitimate sexual assault that's not being properly investigated and/or prosecuted. Then you've got fake complaints that you've got to sort out from legitimate ones. And then you've got commanders who are under pressure not to allow or not to have this sort of thing reflect badly on their record and on their command. So you add all these things up, and you get, like in any other institution run by human beings, and particularly with the kind of tensions the armed forces are going through trying to integrate women into the ranks, it's just kind of a mess.
I have to go to a sponsor break, but when I come back, I have a question I want to ask about what you just said. All right, everybody hang with me. I'll be back in 2 minutes.
All right.
The On the Edge Show with Katie Barnett and friends, the show that gives you real talk about real issues, needs your help. Katie and the gang are seeking out individuals and local business sponsors to help fund their projects for youth and minority communities to become re-empowered, featuring programs like the Spread Your Wings Showcase, offering free advertising to up-and-coming entrepreneurs, Youth Day giving public school grades 4 to 12 a taste of the arts, and All Hands on Deck, our new writer's showcase. On the Edge is looking to give back to our communities by giving our youth a future. Your small contribution will make a difference. Individuals or small businesses can choose to be a sponsor for any amount of time. And businesses can also choose to advertise with us at very reasonable rates. Choose any type of show sponsorship, and you just may be a sponsor for a life. Visit us at Facebook at facebook.com On the Edge Show for more information on how you can be a part of our vision. We hope to see you there.
Now, back with more On the Edge.
Welcome back, everybody, to the On the Edge Show with Katie Barnett and friends. We are winding down here, and for those of you that are just joining us, we are saluting our veterans and our military troops, past, present, and future. We want to say thank you for all the service that the men and women who are veterans have given us, and those that are in their deployed locations now, and those that are joining the troops. We want to thank all of them for what they're doing for us. We have some very intriguing veterans here on the panel giving us some absolutely fantastic, intriguing, and definitely intense conversation and insight. And we are talking with Frank DiConzetti Williams, Brother Larry, and Tony Brown, all of the better veterans. We are going to go right back into our conversation so we can get our last quarter of the hour down before we sign off for the evening.
Yes,
all right,
ma'am. Look, I'd like to give you a little context and perspective on my experience with this so you understand where I'm coming from.
Okay.
Part of my experience in the National Guard, I served my last years in the National Guard in a military police battalion. I was a military police investigator. And one of the things I had a great deal of training in and experience with was sexual assault in the armed forces. And I've kept up with it ever since. And the Pentagon has a report, and they just released one this summer. It's called the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office, and they issued a two-volume report about sexual assault. And they noted that between 2004, according to Volume 1 of the 2013 report, between 2004 and 2012, the number of completed assault cases, including civilians involved with the armed forces, nearly doubled from 1,700 to 3,374. And cases of sexual assault among military personnel escalated from 1,275 to 2,949, an increase of 129%. Now, this isn't the first such report they had. There's been many others, and they've done many other findings. You know, the workplace gender relations survey of active duty members about, and they asked people to respond, and 6.1% of women and 1.2% of men said they had experienced unwanted sexual contact. Now, I'm talking about contact short of sexual assault or rape. You know, somebody coming on to them, maybe touching them in an unwanted manner, that sort of thing. And okay. There's been all sort of theories of what's supposed to be done about this and what should be done. And then you have some people in the Pentagon saying that putting women into land combat roles that heretofore have been barred to them, such as being in the Marine and Army, infantry, armor, artillery, special ops forces, Navy SEALs, in other words, units whose primary mission is to close with, engage, and destroy the enemy. Now, women have never been allowed these kind of roles before, but now they're saying that a way to get more respect for women, so they're not viewed as these ancillary sexual objects, is to let them into these, new military occupational specialties. And, you know, and there's all sorts of this going back, well, should they, shouldn't they, you know, and I'm telling you right now, the military is being hamstrung. Instead of being able to take a hard-eyed, hard-headed view of what is best for the armed forces and efficacy and efficiency with the armed forces, they're being hamstrung by, yes, political correctness, feminists and sexual activists of various sorts, gender identity activists and homosexual activists. And believe me, it is interfering with the proper analysis of what the law enforcement role within the armed forces is. Remember, personnel in the military are subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Okay? That's
Even taking it outside of the military, Frank, I mean, listen, I know the military has a whole other set of rules that they have to play by for various reasons. There's a lot of confidential stuff that have to go on there because the average civilian couldn't stomach or fathom what goes on in the field or in war and combat, understandable. But sexual crimes in the first place, even without the military aspect of it, is something that people don't report as quickly. Or when it is reported, it doesn't get treated as well as it should. My question before the break was going to be this. Do you think that, particularly in the military, the amount of sexual situations that go on, the unwanted advances or the need for it to happen, do you think that it's because of the fact that there's so many restrictions as to where you should be? For example, the best way that I can make an analogy out of it or a comparison is think about the Catholic priests. Now, they're told that in order to be priests or to be proper and holy in the eyes of the Lord, they've got to marry the church. Now, that's not what the Bible says, but they have to marry the church, meaning they have to denounce all human rights to be married, to have a life, to be in love, to do anything but run the church. But they're around these boys, and they weren't allowing women to be in certain roles either. Do you think that there's a higher instance of these men or whoever it is that are the aggressors being aggressive because they're lacking the proper needs to get out there and be interactive with people on a social basis? Do you
when I was growing up as a Catholic, and I grew up as a Catholic, I was involved in the Catholic Church, most priests, I don't recall any of this going on. My friends talking about me, and we were regularly being educated by priests, many of whom were
you an altar boy?
I know I was never an altar boy, but,
exactly.
You know, I went.
There was a couple of things that I was a stout, a devout Catholic for a while because of my mom. And I will tell you this. There's a few things that changed now that was not allowed back then. First of all, very rarely, if ever, was there an African-American allowed to be on an altar boy. And usually the priests that were being accused of this were being accused of assaulting altar boys. It was never just regular parish people. It was altar boys, the ones that were on the inside, being around these priests on the inside base. So
yes.
That's why a lot of it didn't know. Of course, when it came out, it was a shock to all of these people, all of the Catholic parish people.
I'll tell you what the biggest single change in the Catholic Church has been. I don't know if you ever heard of this term or not, but I studied it fairly extensively. It's called the Lavender Mafia.
Yes.
It is a underground network, loosely, and depending upon which aspect you're speaking of, it's a loose affiliation or more tightly knit association of homosexual activists within the Catholic Church, which heretofore had never existed before, outspoken entity. It never existed in the Catholic Church before until recently, until the 1970s. But now it's recognized. Look up the word Lavender Mafia and look at, there was a priest who wrote a book about it, and its influence extends all the way to the Vatican. And many of these homosexual Catholic priests are being protected. Homosexual Catholic priests have always existed within the Catholic Church. Don't misunderstand me. They always have. But they've never had the sort of influence they've had until recently. And this is what's new in the Catholic Church. They've never had the sort of ends in the Catholic Church they've had recently. Most Catholic priests prior to 50 years ago or so were very much heterosexual, even if they were celibate. They were very heterosexual. And they did pretty much honor their vows to the Church. But with the sexual revolution, one of the things that the people who were involved in what, and I'm going a little bit far afield, but if we have more time, I'll explain it. It was called the Frankfurt School. And these people were people who wrote, who were leaders, were people like Herbert Marcuse, Theodore Adorno, and others who came from the Frankfurt School and were creating policies called cultural Marxism, whose very object was to overturn the major cultural institutions within the United States to include religion. And one of the things they intended to do was to undermine the Catholic Church and to weaken people's reliance and respect for religion, because then they could replace it with socialism, Marxism, and communism. And one of the institutions more directly affected by it was the Catholic Church, and the Lavender Mafia was a great part of it. And one of the reasons you're getting all this stuff in the Catholic Church now is what you can look at, the homosexual deconstructive wing of the Lavender Mafia that's doing a lot of this stuff.
And I tend to put it a little more in human nature. Now, I know I've grown up on both ends. Like I said, I had some Catholicism that I practiced because of my mom, but my dad was a Baptist. So I know the Bible had made men and women to be together. He never said that you were supposed to be a leader but not have a wife. As a matter of fact, you were supposed to have a wife evenly yoked to you to do God's work. That's the way I would understand it. Now, I can't see how anybody can force a human nature to be changed, and B, tell somebody who's a human that's born with needs that you got to be for the rest of your life a leader for the Church. You can't have sex. You can't kiss a girl. You can't kiss a guy. You've got to be married to the deity. You just got to talk about the priest, and you got to talk about saints, and you got to do this. There is no way you're going to quash human needs.
Well, pedophilia is illegal whether you're a homosexual or a heterosexual.
Oh, I got you
on
that.
The thing
that
is, with boys, it's homosexual.
No one's thinking about the pedophilia.
Going
no one's thinking
them.
About pedophilia. That's a crime. What I'm saying is the instances that's happening with this, including even in the military. If you are banned from having to be able to do certain things because you have to focus on being alert for enemies or for minds that might be, you know, hidden in grass or something, so your time with family is limited. Would this not cause more of a sensation or an urge for your natural needs to come out and get it either way you can?
Soldiers have to forego all sorts of things
Okay, Frank, I'm sorry. I have to give the other panelists a chance to answer because we're down to 7 minutes. So let me go with you, Tony. Let me go with Tony, Larry, because he was the last one in.
Okay.
Tony, what do you think? Tony?
Yeah.
Do you believe that the instances of sexual harassment in the military or in priests, for example, happen because of the fact that they are physically restricted from doing what naturally a person does when they don't have to deal with these type of situations, such as being constricted into a church, confined and married to the church, and in the sense of soldiers? You guys have to mostly focus on keeping your eyes alert for enemy activity. So do you think that the instances in the military of sexual harassment or rape or whatever is happening because certain things are happening, but they're constricted or restricted from fulfilling these needs?
Huh? Well, there's one thing about there's predators in all types, you know. I mean, there's predators, military, churches. If a person is going to be, you know, manipulative, they will be no matter what job they're doing. Now, in the military, there's a chain of command you have to go through if there's any problems that you don't like. And that has to be looked at other officers above you. But then again, they can depress that because for them to get a good rating, they will try to fix it in-house. You know, talk to the person and say, hey, because he want to look good. Because if he have any complaints that he can't handle, it'll fall a black mark on the officer up in the higher-ups. So they don't want that to get out. That's another catch-22. Because I watch the news all the time. I watch both Fox and, you know, NBC because they got different views on certain things. So I keep my eyes abreast of everything as a whole.
Okay. And what about you, Larry? What do you feel?
Okay, from my experience as a child growing up in public school co-ed and realizing that God did not create man and woman to rebel from each other at any time of any age in any place, I'm sure there will be a distraction. I don't care about the chain of command. I mean, that was said about the chain. These Catholic priests, instead of them busting out boys, they would stick with ladies. You understand what I'm saying? So I believe that it doesn't matter where they're at. God did not create man and woman to repel from each other. And when y'all in the same, is anything is possible. Now, what I'm saying is that's the way, you know, I mean, the aggressiveness of one onto another is okay. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that when a pretty lady's in my presence, I'm always going to use conversation with her to see how close I can get to her. You feel what I'm saying?
I'm asking if you think that the instances of these attacks are happening in military and in the priesthood because of the fact that they are mandated to pretty much be
No. In the priesthood, these Catholic priests, I was told not too long ago by a lady who was born like 10 years before I was. She said once upon a time they used to find babies buried in these Catholics underground. And that means they was having sex with the nuns and making babies and killing them and burying them. So now what they did now, they said, okay, we're not going to go that route. We're going to sexualize the men. Also, back in 1996, there was a black priest, a Catholic priest. A sister came into her church, and I saw her. She was a beautiful sister. And they courtship, and she got pregnant. They kicked them out the church. But yet they cover up the sexual molestation of men. So I don't think it's got to do anything with the mandation. I just feel it has to be that, like I said once, I'll say it again, God did not create man and woman to repel from each other.
Okay. Deacon, are you
Everybody's
back with
different.
One second, Tony. Deacon, are you back? Okay. You were saying, Tony?
So I was saying every individual is different. Now the sciences and the humanities are trying to figure out how can they predict a murderer ahead of time. I mean, you don't know what's in somebody else's head. Somebody's going to do certain things you don't even know. There may be people that, you know, like they said on TV, the guy that gave the secrets away and went to Russia and Germany, that he knew, you know, he didn't even have completed military. Didn't have a high school diploma, but he gets a $120,000 job with the NSA. And I sit back thinking, wow, that's incredible.
And right, I had absolutely. You were talking. We were talking about that on, you know, off the air from a previous segment. Gentlemen, I have to say thank you very much. We're down to our last 2 minutes, and I have to close out the show. But thank you very much to you, Frank, to you, Larry, Deacon, Tony. Thank you for taking the time out to call in. I learned a lot from all of you, for sure. Definitely. What love to hear the passion, you know, coming from veterans. I love to learn a lot more about the inside. I am against war, but I'm not against this defense. When it's necessary, it's necessary. I don't like it being used as a great product that you must have, in, you know, via these glamorous commercials. I think that some truth should come to it. But other than that, you know, I think that to have great soldiers on the fence for us, to have veterans that have had given us the honor of having served us, I thank you all very much for that, because no matter what, at the end of the day, it's about the fact that they're saving our butts and we wouldn't do it. But I just wish that you guys had a better way of being a little more informed, a little more balanced out, protected by the government in that respect from my point of view. So until tomorrow night, everybody, be blessed, be a blessing, make a difference. Good night. Thank you, veterans. Thank you, military.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Good night.
Thank you. Good, thanks for all your service, guys.
And thank you, Frank.
Have a good night, Ms. Bonnet.
Good night.
On the Edge, real talk about real issues.
Have a good night, Ms. Bonnet.